engaging with nature in that urban space can be so beneficial. And if we scale those micro actions up to a macro level, imagine the change that would see the 9 million people living in London, just as one small thing each, how that would be a systemic change across how we embrace nature in London.
Welcome to another episode of Rewilding the World. I'm Ben Goldsmith. I'm sitting here with my friend Elliot Newton from Citizen Zoo. Elliot, thank you so much for taking the time to join me today.
Thank you so much for having me on, Ben. Really looking forward to discussing today with you.
Last October, you might have seen in the newspapers joyful images of the London Mayor Sadiq Khan releasing a pair of beavers into an enclosure in West London in Ealing. And earlier still, some beavers are released into another very large enclosure in Enfield in North London. And there's just a little bit of wildness creeping into our city that wasn't there before. If you've walked in Regent's Park recently, you'll see little fenced out enclosures that are filled with scrub and deadwood. The water's edge along the main watercourse that runs across Regent's Park is suddenly very reedy and wild. There's just stuff happening. There's more nature in our cities. And that's partly because of the Rewilding London Task Force that I co-chaired with Shirley Rodriguez, Deputy Mayor for Climate, who reports to Sadiq. And it's partly because of the work of a bunch of NGOs, at the forefront of which is Citizen Zoo. Elliot and his team are doing some really, really innovative things, bringing species back into London and just weaving wild nature back through the fabric of the place where so many people live. And we've got this idea somehow that nature is separate from us, that is something that we go and visit. You know, it's not something that happens in our cities. It's not something that happens on our farms. It's kind of separate. It's elsewhere. And that's entirely false. You know, we are nature and we need to bring wildlife and bring the habitat that wildlife needs right back to our doorsteps. So that's what Citizen Zoo is all about. And I'm really, really excited to be here with you, Elliot. How did it all start for you, Elliot? Well, how did you come to be where you are now?
Oh, well, I think as many people who work in and work in conservation, you know, childhood is such a formative period for that. So I grew up in Southwest London, and I spent my childhood running around, enjoying being in green spaces, climbing trees. And I think that really fostered my sort of, you know, relationship with nature. And I suppose, you know, growing up for the teenage years, I didn't realise conservation was something you could really work in. It's not something you get people coming into school saying this is a career path you could potentially pursue. So it took me a while to realise that conservation is, you know, actually a place where you can, you know, try and actually make a career out of. So after a few sort of meanderings in various careers, I went to do a conservation master's at Imperial College called Conservation Science. That sort of really helped open my eyes to the world of conservation and rewilding. And then out of that, myself and a fellow student on the course called Lucas, we said, okay, we really learn how important it was to integrate and embrace communities at the heart of rewilding projects and conservation projects generally. And we thought, okay, you know what, should we actually try and establish a small NGO and try and really see if we can be proactive and really build communities into the heart of our conservation programs and take, you know, quite an urban approach. And yeah, here we are, a good few years later, and we're still going strong, and there's lots of fantastic projects, and we're recruiting more urban rewilding officers all the time. So it really has been a fantastic journey.
So what's the shape of Citizen Zoo now? How many people geographically, where exactly are you?
Yeah, so we're still a relatively small organisation, but we're certainly growing. We're actually currently recruiting for another urban rewilding officer. So we most of our projects are focused in London, because that's where we see, you know, so much opportunity and opportunities to, you know, how reinvent or sort of introduce rewilding principles in a way that might be quite different to some of your other guests who join you on this podcast. But we've currently got two full-time urban rewilders, and then we've got some sort of other staff who help do funding and stuff like that. So we're still small, but we're definitely growing, and we just see so many opportunities to really get stuck into some exciting projects. And one thing I should say, all of the projects that we do have the community at the heart, right? So, for example, our Water Vault project had over 350 volunteers. So it's not just the Citizen Zoo core team, it's the communities in and around those spaces that really make it special. And we also, all of our projects are based on collaboration with a whole range of organisations, because, you know, we can't really do things on our own. We have to have that collaborative mindset. So that's sort of how we always, that's sort of our modus operandi, I suppose.
And the timing feels absolutely perfect for building an organization like yours, because there is this kind of upwelling of love for nature that the country is experiencing. And it doesn't seem to be confined to a particular demographic, you know, young, old, urban, rural, rich, poor, left-leaning, right-leaning. Everyone suddenly is very, very excited by the idea that we can have vibrant nature and abundant wildlife back in our country. I think lots of people didn't really realize how depleted of nature our country has become. They sort of thought that the landscapes that we see are somehow normal, you know, that these are already full of nature. But there's been a kind of education process that's sort of taken place somehow in the last few years. And people now look at our landscapes and our cityscapes and our seascapes differently, and they yearn for much more nature. And so I think having the public kind of behind you in, with this zeitgeist and wanting to participate in it really presents an interesting opportunity. I've seen the Rivers Trust, for example, which is concerned with keeping pollution out of our rivers and improving the water quality and the vitality of our river systems. They've recruited enormous numbers of citizen scientists and people who just love to walk along their local river every day to do water sampling and to report pollution incidents and so on. And so I think once you've got the public as a kind of as an extension of your organization, I think it's just really a recipe for big, big change. So can we talk about that? Can we talk about the Water Vole project that you're doing? Maybe start with the story of water voles in London. I never knew that water voles had been in London in anything like recent past.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, water voles are an incredible species. I think they have the very unfortunate title of the UK's fastest declining mammal. In my lifetime, which is just over 30 years or so, we've lost about 97% is probably what we're looking at in terms of their decline. So, and water voles just have a fundamental role in an ecosystem. They're the foundation of the food web. They help to feed a whole range of species like, you know, herons and foxes. And they also help to create habitat in terms of these amazing complex burrows they build into riverbanks, which, you know, things like grass snake can potentially live in. And of course, they can eat about 227 different types of plants. So they have a really important role in sort of how they forage on the riverbanks and also spreading seeds. So they are a fundamental part of our ecosystem. So by not having them, our ecosystems are impoverished. And London would have had, you know, water voles on all of its rivers at one point, you know. So it's something that, you know, we should hopefully aspire to have water voles back on all of our river systems where we can get them. We focus, one of our water vole projects focuses on the Hogs Mill River, which is in southwest London. It's a lovely chalk stream. There's about two chalk streams in London. Water voles, we thought, went extinct probably actually quite recently on that river. 2017 is what we're sort of looking at with the last formal record. But if you went back to 1851, say, when the very famous Pre-Raphaelite painter John Everard Millais painted a painting called Ophelia, which was a sort of very famous Pre-Raphaelite painting. He actually painted the background of that in 1851 on the Hogs Mill River. And at the time, he recorded, you know, huge, you look at his diaries, and the river at the time was teeming with water voles, and he was even putting water voles in buckets to try and sketch them. But unfortunately for a painter of his caliber, he still couldn't quite perfect the water vole. So when he presented his original canvas of Ophelia to his Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood friends, they said, "Oh, yeah, that looks a bit like a cat or a rat." So he was told to take it out. So it's quite unfortunate that the waterfall didn't remain. But if you take the print out of its frame and look at the edge of the canvas, you can still see little water vole sketches. So we know water voles had a very sort of significant role within the London ecosystems, but, you know, there's very few sort of populations clinging on in there. So in 2019, we launched a project called Get Involved, which is all about how the communities can try and work together to try and restore and reverse that species extinction, right? Because we know that humans have been at the forefront of leading the sort of sixth mass extinction that we're currently running through. But our ethos is that people can, if we work together, we give them the right skills, we can actually try and reverse those extinction events and help rebuild healthier, more intact ecosystems. So, yeah, without going too much into it, over the course of the last sort of 5 years or so, we trained people to see the world through the eyes of a water vole, and we carried out these really important water vole feedability surveys in terms of the habitat quality. That was advised by rewilding pioneers like Derek Gow, who helped us to go along the way. And then we also carried out habitat restoration. We also engaged with dog walkers, because especially in the urban space, we've really got to think how dog walkers use those spaces and the impacts that they can have on wildlife like water voles. We created things called dead hedges, which are these barriers that we can, so natural features that we can put along the side of riverbanks that give a little bit of protective buffer and also create habitat for birds to nest in. So we created, you know, hundreds of meters of that. And then we were in a position where we, after some fundraising and some community, more community engagement, getting people excited by water voles, by doing things like festivals, which is like a mini play on words with festivals, where we got kids wearing face masks of water voles. And then about in 2022, we actually released 101 water voles back onto the Hogsmill. And now we're doing lots of post-release monitoring to monitor their presence. And of course, one thing we have to always consider with water voles is not only habitat, but also American mink. So we're also surveying for American mink, which are an invasive species that can actually be very detrimental to not only water voles, but a whole load of ground nesting birds too. So that's our project on the Hogsmill. We're really happy with how it's going, and we want to use that as a sort of a case study in how we can try and get urban communities excited by these species and use them as a way to try and restore our natural environments.
Elliot, I was recently shown the Wandle, which is a stream in Wandsworth, and it was explained to me that this little stream or small river had been culverted under the ground for a long time until being resurfaced in recent years, and that lots of the rivers and streams in London historically had just simply been buried, and they're now beneath our feet, running like sewers along pipes under the ground, which of course limits the amount of habitat available for us to restore and for species like water voles and so on. You explained to me once that London really is a kind of riverine coastal city at heart, but we just don't see it in the way that perhaps our predecessors did.
Yeah, we have a really fascinating history of doing those sort of engineering works to our rivers. One thing I like doing in London is following stink pipes, so going on stink pipe safaris. So obviously, because effectively our sewage network has been integrated with that historic sort of tapestry of rivers. So to stop the gas build up in the Victorian era with the Bazalgette invention of the sort of the sewage network, they put stink pipes along the top of these rivers that we've incarcerated in concrete. And yeah, so you can actually follow some of the historic rivers like the Ephra and by the stink pipes. So it's a real sort of insight to that sort of, you know, the ecological history that many have forgotten. But there are many fantastic ways, especially in outer London, where we can try and have the technologies to try and restore these river systems by daylighting them where possible, which is really, really important work. So I think many people forget that London is actually sort of a coastal city, a riverine city almost. And up until the Teddington Lock, you know, the Thames is this tidal system with brackish water. And it's not uncommon to see dolphins coming upstream. I regularly see sort of seals. And just outside the Globe Theatre, we have a population of seahorses that live right there. I believe they're sort of short-snouted seahorses. And so we have this amazing complex ecology that is happening right in front of us that many people just don't even know exists.
The estuary is absolutely amazing. I mean, occasionally I've flown into City Airport and you forget that there's this huge estuary at the heart of London. And in fact, when we sat together, Elliot, you and I, on the Rewilding London Task Force, we collectively established a goal of restoring six large areas of self-willed nature, six big rewilding projects around the periphery of London. And two of them are on either side of the Thames estuary and restoring grazed marshes. Crayford and Dagenham were the two projects we talked about. But in the estuary itself, you've got these dolphins and occasional whales, you've got seals, you've got extraordinary aggregations of seabirds. And now that there's a wind farm in the estuary, it's much harder for the commercial trawler boats to get into the estuary itself. So you now have tremendous recovery of fish and other marine life. So it's almost like a kind of huge marine nature reserve right in the very heart of our city.
Yeah, London wouldn't be here if the Thames wasn't here, right? That sort of source of life flowing into the city is incredible. And watching nature recover, because I think some people forget that in 1950, the Thames was declared ecologically dead. And now we've got about 125 species of fish that are coming in. European eels, a species, again, that was critically endangered, again, suffered a population decline of about 97%. But we are seeing European eels starting to potentially recover in London as we remove these physical barriers. So really by embracing the Thames and seeing it as this incredible asset that lives alongside the 9 million people living in London, it really is important for us to embrace that.
Has Citizen Zoo not proactively reintroduced eels in some parts of London in recent years?
So eels aren't something that Citizen Zoo have particularly worked on, but there's some amazing organisations that have. The Zoological Society of London has been doing lots of work on eels, getting people to survey them as they come through their migration from the Sargasso Sea. I believe South East Rivers Trust, again, a fantastic organisation that have done a lot on the Wandle, have actually done work on brown trout, and they've got school children to go out and put trout onto the river. So using local school children to do that, because you know, I think London has so many people living here. I think one of its largest challenges is how we engage those 9 million people. But of course, it's an incredible opportunity. All these people are budding conservationists. Some might not even know it yet. And we can actually, if we can engage them properly, we can get them involved in some really fantastic conservation work. But to do that, we need them to recognise the amazing biodiversity that London holds.
And a single striking wildlife experience can be life-changing for you. You know, seeing a peregrine falcon, for example, for the first time, you know, especially if you witness it catching a pigeon in midair or something, you know, that's something you never forget and can unleash a lifelong fascination with nature. And we want Londoners and city dwellers up and down the country to have more of those kinds of experiences. Some of the species that I've fantasized about seeing in London, the Thames estuary, white-tailed eagles, white storks, you know, these are all species that are being proactively reintroduced in other parts of the country. Now, do you think we'll see those species back on the Thames estuary? What about pelicans? In earlier times, there were pelicans in the Somerset Levels and the Norfolk Fens. Now, could we see pelicans back in the Thames estuary, do you think, in our lifetime?
Oh, well, what a fantastic vision. So just to sort of unpick that a little bit, I think first thing we need to recognise, within the UK right now, 84% of people are living in urban environments. So it's where most of our people live. So if we, as you said at the start, we want people to embrace nature on a daily basis. It shouldn't be something that we have to go travel to. We want nature to be integrated into our cities. And of course, by definition, a city is what we want it to be. It's an accumulation of innovation and engineering. So it's up for us to decide what London can look like in the future. In a way, if we have the political will and the public will, we could turn London into an incredible system that embraces nature. And already there is some fantastic nature here to work with. But just to sort of unpick some of those species that you've just run through there, Ben. So of course, peregrine falcons at the start. London's now got over 40 pairs of peregrine falcons living across it. The world's fastest animal that's ever lived on our planet, and they're living right here in London. We've created a haven for peregrines with these tall towers that they can nest on. And then you mentioned white storks. Citizen Zoo is actually starting to look at a program of what is the role of white storks potentially within London. Of course, there's some fantastic work happening with the White Stork Project, that's seen white storks being reintroduced to NEP and Wadhurst Place, other places across the UK. And in the last 10 years, we've got about 40 records of white storks coming into London as their ranges expand. So something that Citizen Zoo are looking to do is a big feasibility study of what could white storks look like in London as a sort of symbol for ecological recovery. Because we know that across Europe, for example, you know, these aren't a wilderness species. You know, white storks can actually live very well in urban settings. So can London be a place where white storks can thrive alongside people and be a symbol for ecological recovery? I think they could, but we're about to embark on some work to see how we might actually help to realise that, working with people like the fantastic team at the White Stork Project and the Royal Parks potentially as well. So that could be an incredible way of just resetting aspirations, challenging perceptions of what's possible in our urban realm.
One of the great wildlife spectacles I've ever seen have been enormous numbers of white storks kettling in the skies above central Madrid, you know, late last year. And you know, what a sight that would be in London. You know, imagine storks nesting again on, you know, St. Paul's Cathedral and some of the other taller buildings in London. It would be really something. And that's what I think we're lacking in the conservation movement, is this sense of ambition. You know, we're held back by lots of caution and we've sort of settled to some degree with what we've got, when in fact we could have so much more. We can dream big. We can dream of pelicans, I think, back in Britain. You know, Dalmatian pelicans were commonplace in Northern Europe just a handful of centuries ago. And who'd have thought 10 years ago, let's say, that there'd be beavers living and breeding in London again. I mean, that's something that Citizen Zoo has made happen, and it's a completely mind-blowing story. Tell us a little bit about how that came about.
We are true beaver believers at Citizen Zoo, absolutely. And I think 3 years ago, actually, we set up something called the London Beaver Working Group, recognising, again, that beavers aren't wilderness species. You know, if you look at Munich, you look at Berlin, you look at places in North America like Vancouver, you have beavers living in the heart of these urban systems. And acknowledging the fact that, you know, Kent has about 300 free living beavers in it, it's not without outside the realms of possibility that beavers would naturally recolonise London in the next sort of 10 years or so. So, and we wanted that to be a positive thing. We want people not to be scared of that. We wanted to have some showcase some examples of how beavers can actually live alongside people in London and be a real asset for how we manage our landscapes and engage people with nature. So we've done a fantastic project, a collaborative project called the Ealing Beaver Project, working with Ealing Council, the Ealing Wildlife Group and the Friends of Horsenden Hill, where we've reintroduced a family of five beavers into an 8-hectare enclosure in Greenford, a very urban space. You have to park in McDonald's to get into this on a retail park to get into this beaver enclosure. It's really pioneering in the sense that anybody can go into it at any time, so it's freely accessible, so people can learn to live alongside beavers in a very urban setting. And we've been absolutely amazed about the sort of the public reception and how they've been received in the local community.
Is there habitat for free wild living populations of beavers throughout London, do you think?
Oh, that again is a fantastic question. So just in terms of habitat feasibility, on the Ealing site, we worked with the Beaver Trust and Exeter University to work out where we were putting our beavers, that there is absolutely fantastic habitat for them and they're thriving. But across London, we know that there is going to be habitat, especially in places like the Colne Valley, in the Lee Valley, it's out of London. I'm sure there is potential for free living beavers. And that's the aspiration. But at the moment, we have to work within the confines of the legislation. But I do think there's a role for free living beavers in London in the future.
Yeah, and probably not that distant a future, because beavers are spreading quite fast from the west. You know, they're in Cornwall, Devon, Dorset, Wiltshire, Hampshire now, up into Gloucestershire. As you said, there's a large free-living population of beavers in Kent, so it's just a matter of time. And enormous amounts of habitat as well, a little bit further out of London, towards Windsor, for example. All those old gravel pits along the M4 and between the M4 and the M3, lots of habitat there. So I think we're going to see beavers living back in our city in the near future. Elliot, are you doing anything with glowworms? I mean, nothing symbolises the romance of wild habitat in an English landscape than glowworms. And I've only ever seen glowworms once, as it happens, in a beaver wetland in Somerset. We don't have them in the city, presumably. Are you doing work on glowworms?
So we've got a fantastic site in southwest London called Tolworth Court Farm, which we hope to actually resemble a mini version of the Nep Estate in London environment. And we think that site there, because it's got dark skies, could be an absolutely fantastic site to put glowworms. So we're hoping to work with people like Peter Cooper, who's been leading on glowworms, to see if we can try and reintroduce glowworms to this site so people could come in to this urban environment and see the amazing light of the glowworms flickering in the dark skies. I think it'd be an absolutely magical experience and be one of those things that, you know, helps to redefine what we should expect from an urban nature reserve.
And Elliot, how can people living in London who want to involve themselves in the kind of work you do, you know, they want to get their hands dirty ripping out invasive species or clearing up plastic or planting trees or releasing eels or glowworms or water voles or beavers, how can they get stuck in? What do they do?
Well, the first thing to say at Citizen Zoo, every single one of our projects, anybody can come and help be part of that. So all of our projects have volunteering opportunities. But I think one thing we must recognise, rewilding in the London sense can be any scale. You can rewild your windowsill. You can help, you know, any small part of it, just engaging with nature in that urban space can be so beneficial. And if we scale those micro actions up to a macro level, imagine the change that would see the 9 million people living in London just did one small thing each, how that would be a systemic change across how we embrace nature in London. So I think it's about embracing London, embracing the nature we can find in London, looking for the incredible species that are living right here, and just trying to say, actually, yeah, I want to live alongside nature.
Now, I never forget the story of the Forestry Commission, which came up with a wonderful plan to liberate and re-wiggle one of the rivers down in the New Forest. I think it was a Lyndhurst. And the local population really refused, and quite aggressively refused, because they like the straight line, they like the towpath, they like it all neat and tidy, where they walk their dogs along and chuck some bread in for the mallard ducks. And the idea of turning that into a multi-braided, shallow, meandering, wild river really didn't appeal at all. And it's the same kind of thing when councils do no mow May and they allow the roundabouts and the road verges to grow up with wildflowers and thistles, and lots of butterflies come in and so on. And they inevitably get letters saying, what are our taxes for if you're not spending them keeping our place tidy? You know, how do you overcome that, you know, among the populations among whom you're working with these projects, which do create mess? Water vole habitat is messy. Beavers make it even more suitable for water voles and even more messy.
Yeah, a really fantastic question there, Ben. So across London, we've got over 9 million people living. And of course, each of these people have their own perceptions of what they think London should be like. I think there is a history of that neat and tidiness that sort of comes out of the Victorian period. Education is a really important part of this. So almost half of London is green or blue space. And we want to tell people actually London should be a place where people can engage with nature and actually sort of re-challenge sort of the typical perceptions. One fantastic campaign that helped to really sort of help address those sort of neat and tidy perceptions is London becoming the world's first national park city. So what does that mean to live in a national park city? Does that mean, oh, actually, we can have some, you know, we can go to a park and there should be some flat grass where you can play football, that's absolutely fine. But also around the edges, we should have some longer grass, some wildflower areas, maybe a small pond, and integrating those small little, you know, interventions that we can do to try and just make nature part of a daily experience. And, you know, for example, walking along a high street and having some plants that are planted for pollinators. That is something that I'm sure we can all try and address and try and introduce into our lives. So I think a lot of it is education, just trying to say London is full of 16,000 species can be found in London. And yeah, just trying to celebrate that. And then just trying to, with that knowledge, hopefully we can try and encourage some people to embrace nature a little bit more.
Yeah, that was sort of the conclusion that we all came to in the Rewilding London Task Force is that we really need to establish some core areas in which self-willed nature can recover under the effect of natural processes of the kinds you might find at NEP or in some of the larger rewilding projects around the country. And those are underway in places like Hainault and Enfield, and there's one in Croydon, and various places where you've got proper nature. But then we need to connect them up with veins of nature that run through the city. You know, the canals, for example, offer lots of space alongside the railway sidings, road verges. And then, of course, those terrace gardens that you mentioned. You know, if you can get holes in the fence for hedgehogs to move along and get people to plant more native vegetation, things like hawthorn and crabapple, instead of the exotic nonsense that we buy from garden centres because we think it looks pretty, or even worse, the plastic plants and plastic grass that are starting to become popular. If you can start to create these threads of nature that run through the city, you know, and connect up with larger areas of wild habitat, then really you give nature a chance to come right back into the very center of our lives living here in London. And of course, there's flat roofs. I read as one of the reports that we looked at during that Rewilding London Task Force that there are something like 650 hectares of flat roofs in London. You know, all of those can be wonderful habitat. You know, you scatter a bit of rubble, you know, they call them rubble roofs, with a bit of topsoil, and they look after themselves with wildflowers and wild grasses and so on. Lovely habitat for black redstarts and butterflies, invertebrates and all kinds of things. Now, there's no reason why the city shouldn't be absolutely thrumming with non-human life. You know, I think it would just enhance our own quality of life so much. I think it's a birthright thing. You know, I think there's a tremendous societal injustice that very large numbers of people in this country simply don't have access to nature. You know, and we talk a lot about investing better in the ability of urban schools to get kids out into the countryside. And that's great. Of course, we want to do that. But why shouldn't they come out their front door and see real nature? Now, I think we know that nature is of visceral importance to our well-being in ways that we really don't understand yet. You know, the Japanese health service now prescribes contact with nature, and forest bathing, they call it. And we know that people get better faster if they've been unwell, if they spend time in nature. So it's sort of a birthright thing. And that's why I think the work of Citizen Zoo and London Wildlife Trust and these other organizations that are doing these projects in the city is just so important. And I think Citizen Zoo, really, you're pushing the envelope. You're doing stuff that is incredibly out there, you know, bringing beavers back to the city and involving hundreds or even thousands of citizens in doing that. And just so grateful for what you do, Elliot, and for you having taken this time to talk to me. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much for having me on, Ben. And yeah, if you want to come visit our beavers or see some of our London wildlife sites, you'd be most welcome anytime.
There's a misconception that you need to own a lot of land or have a load of resources at your disposal to get involved in rewilding, and it's entirely wrong. No, anyone, anywhere can get stuck into rewilding, and Elliot and his organisation, Citizen Zoo, are showing how it's done here in London. Lots of people are participating in their projects, and there's just so much joy around the work that they're doing. So I suggest people reach out to organisations local to them and see how they can get involved in rewilding efforts. If you've enjoyed the episode as much as I enjoyed making it, I'd be so grateful if you'd give us a plug on whatever platform you use to listen to these podcasts. Next time, I'm going to be talking to Jenny Daltrey, who's in Antigua. Jenny's been involved in all kinds of rewilding efforts in a place that we really do associate with holidays of a lifetime, the Caribbean region, a place that is far more nature depleted than anyone really understands. Now, Jenny and her team are doing wonderful things to restore life to Antigua specifically and some of the surrounding islands. I hope you'll join us.